Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of medical debate, dialogue, healthcare and science in the news, and lots of discussion. Answers to both your call-in questions and your emails. So, what more could you ask for on a Saturday morning? But before I go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Wow, it's been a wonderful week, if I say so myself, and lots of interesting stories for you. We're going to start off talking about brains, always a good topic in October, I think. What with the sort of zombiegeist in brains are important, both as a nutritive source and also, more importantly, as the things that we think with. And brain research has been moving in leaps and bounds, fueled, among other things, by a fair amount of funding aimed at trying to deal with the looming epidemic of the baby boomers getting into the Alzheimer's and Parkinson's age and the large amount of, well, potential cost that goes for nursing someone who isn't able to care for himself. So neuroregeneration and stroke recovery are very, very hot topics in research. Now, it wasn't that long ago that we thought that once you killed a neuron, that was it, and that neurons don't regenerate. But research has actually shown that that's, well, pretty much completely incorrect. And in fact, that nerve cells can and do regenerate. The research I'm about to tell you about comes from mouse work, but there is ample work in humans as well that validates these concepts, and more about that in a moment. This particular research I'm about to tell you about comes from Lund University and Karolinska Institute in Sweden, and it was just published in the journal Science. What these researchers were doing were inducing strokes in mice and then following the recovery and trying to elucidate the mechanism. Now, there are not just neurons in your brain. There are a group of cells called astrocytes, so-called because they have a kind of a star shape. And these astrocytes were thought to be kind of an immune cell and a support cell, but they also turn out to be stem cells. And astrocytes turn into what are called nerve progenitor cells. And of course, progenitor is kind of parent. Yes, these are cells that can become new neurons. And what the researchers at Karolinska Institute discovered is that they found the signaling mechanism that regulates the conversion of astrocytes into nerve cells. In a healthy brain, under ordinary circumstances, this signaling mechanism is active, and as most things in the brain, it's inhibitory, so it inhibits the formation of new neurons. When there's an injury, such as a stroke, this signaling mechanism, which is being produced by the cells that were just killed by the stroke, now is not active, and the astrocytes, being unsuppressed, begin basically mutating or transforming into nerve progenitor cells and then into neurons. What's really cool is that the researchers have found ways of blocking the signaling mechanism. So in other words, they have found the go signal, the start signal in mice that stimulates the development of new neurons. Now, it's not too far to imagine that maybe we can be applying this in humans. And in fact, there are already several natural compounds I want to tell you about that are available and may, in fact, really have some serious legs. Now, there's a long, let me talk a little bit about the hippocampus, because that's the seat of memory. And obviously, with Alzheimer's disease, that's the focus. And we do know that stress, chronic stress, actually shrinks your hippocampus. And we can see this on functional MRI. So over a long period of time, let's say if you're a caregiver, if you have a very high stress job and you're working, you know, 120 hours a week, the part of your brain that's responsible for memory actually shrinks. And the hippocampus is also responsible for, well, basically taking short-term memory and turning it into long-term memory. And we know that with Alzheimer's disease, one of the things we see is changes in the hippocampus. And actually, in hereditary forms of Alzheimer's disease, and I covered this research several months ago with you, you can see these hippocampal differences in infants who have the bad genetic predisposition towards Alzheimer's disease, which is to say the double APOE4 allele in their DNA. So already, even in infancy, there are differences in the way the hippocampus works, increased vulnerability in older age. And certainly the two drivers for this that have been independently elucidated are stress and inflammation. So your diet can have an effect, and the presence or absence of your ability to relax and calm down. In other words, a healthy lifestyle doesn't just include eating the right things and exercises. It also includes downtime to help heal your hippocampus. Now, I promised you I was going to tell you about some nutritional products. The first of these is a group of compounds called ginsenosides, and these are found in Panax ginseng. One in particular, called RG3, is under development for intranasal use to help heal brains. So oral RG3, 5 milligrams twice a day. In a study of combat veterans with traumatic brain injury and PTSD, showed substantial improvement, and this was on functional MRI. So we're looking at the brain healing. This is not something that could be subject to a placebo response, or if it is a placebo response, my attitude here is bring it on, because these brains were visibly healed by the use of a nasal spray containing an extract of ginseng. Now, could you get the same thing by taking ginseng orally? Probably. What's the dose? Well, about 1 gram or 2 grams of raw Panax ginseng. Another kind of ginseng, Korean red ginseng, actually has even higher levels of RG3. And there is a study showing that this also improves vascular stiffness in people with coronary artery disease. So lowers your risk of stroke, also improves your memory. What's not to love about ginseng? A second compound found in dairy food, a form of niacin called nicotinamide riboside, also works wonders in the brain. It's essentially fuel. It is a substrate called NAD. NAD is nicotinamide adenine something or other. I'm sorry, I don't remember what the D stands for. And NAD, it fuels biochemical reactions in the mitochondria. We know that the mitochondria start dying off over time, over age, from exposure to heavy metals, from exposure to environmental stress, from exposure to free radicals. Gradually, your mitochondria, as you age, lose efficiency. If we can turn that around or find substances that support the mitochondrial efficiency, we can support our brain functioning. And the research is preliminary. The data is massive, and it's clear. You can see the trend lines forming. There's going to be a cocktail of brain food, of nutrients that support brain functioning, that will be validated, synergistic compounds that are going to be recommended. And you can sort of see it coming together. It's very exciting. And you stay tuned right here. Keep listening to Ask Dr. Dawn, because I am going to stay on top of this and bring you the information as it comes to me. We're going to go now to our first program caller, and that is Teresa in Aromas. Hello, Teresa. Welcome to the program.
Yes. Hi, Dr. Dawn. Thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate it. My question is, I have a 65-year-old sister with primary progressive MS. She's had it for over 30 years. Anyway, she's wheelchair-bound, and she's currently suffering with sciatica. She's had episodes in the past, but this one's been ongoing for about 2 months. She's originally, when she got sciatica, she could take Tegretol, like a minimal dose, about 15 milligrams a day. Well, she tried that with this current episode, up to 100 milligrams, three times a day, but she had bad side effects. It caused her her fingers to go into like a fist-like form. So she wasn't able to continue taking that, and she wasn't really getting relief. Now she's on Neurontin, 300 milligrams about four times a day, and that's not working either. So I was wondering if you had any suggestions for treatment.
Well, it would depend upon why she has sciatica. Technically, sciatica is a pinched sciatic nerve, and there's several different places the nerve can be pinched. Obviously, this is a physical diagnosis problem, and often imaging studies are required. I would also point out that sometimes people use the term sciatica for any pain that runs down the back of the leg, and not all pains that run down the back of the leg are actually from a pinched sciatic nerve. So the first thing is for her to see a good diagnostician and have an exam and determine the source of her sciatica. Do you by any chance know why she has sciatica?
Well, she had an MRI of, I guess, her lower back.
Yeah.
The MRI, according to her physical medicine rehabilitation doctor, didn't show any narrowness or anything where the nerve was getting. So the doctors thought it was neuropathy from the MS.
Well, that's possible. And in that case, of course, those are the appropriate drugs for this. But you said she was wheelchair bound. So I'm going to throw out the idea, and I don't know if she's had the exam for it, but it's fairly straightforward physical exam. But she might have spasm of the buttocks muscles that are pinching. Sorry?
Pardon me. She does say that it really originates in her cheek.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a concept called piriformis syndrome. That's P-I-R-I. It's named after the shape of the muscle. It's kind of a pyramid-shaped muscle. And it's one of the muscles that you sit on that people can develop spasm in it, and it will give them sciatica. And so the use of an antispasmodic might be tried. And also sometimes you can do deep tissue massage and various kinds of physical medicine release techniques that will reduce the spasm. So my thought would be, go back with her to the doctor, mention the thing about the buttocks, have her checked for the piriformis syndrome, and if in fact that is what's going on, then physical therapy, and as I said, mentioned muscle relaxants and sometimes deep needling. There's some acupuncture protocols where you go, I mean, they're kind of scary looking needles because they're like 4 inches long, but it's the butt, you know, you're going through, you know, 2 inches of fat and then, you know, another 2 inches of muscle. So you're really not in much danger of damaging anything in that area. But like I said, the needles are, I hide those needles from my patients. I don't let them see those needles just because they're too long. They're scary. They look like, sometimes you'll see the people in certain religions or in India, you know, they're street performers and they stick like long skewers through themselves. And yeah, it has that kind of creep out quality when you see it. But hey, it can work really well. And as I said, the chances of any substantial injury are low. So keep knocking at the door. Open up to other possibilities. There may be something more here, especially, like I said, the MRI is not, if there isn't a big disc, then you got to start thinking out of the box a bit, okay?
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the call. I'm sure you've helped other people with your call as well.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
This too, Sean, speaking of helping other people, Sean sent a letter a few weeks ago and then someone else responded to it. So I'm going to recap Sean's second letter here, Balance and Anxiety. I called a couple of weeks ago about feeling unbalanced at times, especially in grocery stores and certain highly active social situations, although it does often happen to me when I'm alone as well. Anxiety seems to be the biggest possibility, but I'm curious because I'm not consciously aware of being anxious. Might there be a possible neurological or physiological problem or tic that could be exacerbated by either a stressful situation or thought or food? If so, would you recommend any potential treatments? And one of the and I had answered this talking about anxiety, but then someone messaged me and I read that on the air, but Sean, I don't think you caught it because you wrote this. There is something called visual vertigo syndrome, and this is an oculovestibular function. Turns out that our brain links our vision and our ears, our balance organ, very, very tightly. And in fact, that's used in neurology. It's one of the ways we determine the level of nerve damage that someone might have in a head injury. It's one of the, after a severe stroke, it's diagnostic in certain ways. You turn the head right and left. Do the eyes roll to the top or do the eyes stay staring straight ahead? When you spin around in a circle too many times, I'm sure we all did this as children, so you can't stand up straight. If you look at what the eyeballs are doing, the eyeballs are zigging and zagging back and forth. And of course, anyone who's ever studied dance knows that you, in order to keep spinning around and not fall over, you do something called spotting, where you use your eyeballs to override your sense of balance so that you stay upright. And these are all techniques that can be learned. You may suffer from essentially an over-reliance on your vision to keep your balance. People who have this have what's called visual vertigo. When they're in a too bright, too shiny, too many lines kind of environment, too many lines, too many colors, sound like your typical supermarket? Sure does to me. Then you literally lose your balance because your balance organ isn't the dominant one. Your visual one is, and that's being interfered with by all of the extra visual input. There are definitely exercises that would help with this. And so what you are looking for is you're looking for oculovestibular rehabilitation therapy. I sent you an email with some recommendations of where you might find that therapy. I want to put out a pitch, or no, a shout out, I should say, to the Community Hospital of the Monterey Peninsula, because they did a fabulous job. And they helped me out with a couple of patients, and they have a good vestibular recovery therapist or two down there. So it's a bit of a hike from Ben Lomond, but Sean, I think that's your best bet. We're going to go to a couple of letters now. This one from Bruce in Elkhorn, who is a regular listener, and I'm sure a supporter of this program. Bruce has sent a link to a very good article in Business Week looking at problems with development of Ebola drugs. And essentially, the gist of this article is that for some reason, the Pentagon actually controls funding for the development of the vaccine or any drug treatments for these viruses that come out of Africa. So Ebola, Marburg, these are considered to be not public health issues in the United States, but instead, I guess, national security issues, and therefore they gave it to the Pentagon, which is a really bad thing because the Pentagon buys bombers and they understand tech and engineering at that level, but they don't quite get drugs and pharmaceuticals. And the criteria that you use, you know, the sorts of things that you would look at for a grant to build a new bomber just don't work for drugs. And unfortunately, they're very worried about another $10,000 toilet seat problem. And again, we get back to certain news channels which just jump on stuff like that. And, I think what's the one Charlie told me about lately? There's like all of this wetlands stuff that's going on that's trying to, you know, protect areas from hurricanes, and it has huge economic implications. But there's also this mouse. And so what the people who oppose the government on just general principle, it's like, we're spending $300 million to save this mouse. No, we're spending $300 million to preserve the wetlands so we don't have to spend $10,000 million on, you know, rebuilding the city of New Orleans. And you think, and you're going to make it about a mouse because you just, you know, need to make your silly political point. We've got to get, I'm grandstanding, but I really get crazy about this. So Ebola is an issue in Africa. It is not going to be a major epidemic here because we have the ability to contain it. But we do need to be rational about how we approach it. And one of the things that's getting in the way is the cost of medical care in this country. And I had two people write in with this, but Bruce alluded to it, and also Ed and Ben Lohman alluded to it. And here's what they said. You know what? People are afraid to go to the hospital when they're sick if they don't have health insurance because they know they're looking at, you know, in the case of someone like myself who's an entrepreneur, if I go to the ER, I'm looking at $6,000 because that's my deductible. And assuming that I am actually sick, I'm looking at $6,000 before my insurance kicks in. That's how it works. If I were in a different situation economically, I can absolutely see how that $6,000 might stop me from going to the hospital. Now, what if I was in the situation of Thomas Eric Duncan and I had just gotten back from Africa and I was sick and I didn't have health insurance? Because that is exactly the case with this gentleman. And, you know, some people are saying that's why he wasn't admitted to the hospital the first time. I can't verify that one way or another. But what I can say is that Ed had a good idea, and he sent a letter. He sent a letter to Dianne Feinstein and a bunch of our other representatives, suggesting that maybe if Ebola screening and care, if you go to the hospital because you think you might have an illness, if during an epidemic, during a situation like this, where we really want people to come out from the woodwork if they're at risk, maybe we should just pay for that. Maybe the government should foot the bill and we should have some mechanism for some kind of granting mechanism in a circumstance like this so that people do receive health care. Now, of course, they should anyway. That would be a just society. But in a situation like this, the injustice of our health care funding system could absolutely shoot us in the foot in terms of containing a disease outbreak. Do we want that? Think it through. Do you really want that? Absolutely. Okay. Enough grandstanding. Oh, by the way, Charlie wants me to tell you that the PBS Nova Ebola documentary was excellent and to go check it out at pbs.org/Nova. We are going to read one more email here. This from Danielle. I am 34 years old and have been a competitive endurance athlete my entire life. I no longer compete, but still exercise quite a bit, about 2 hours a day of running, swimming, biking, and weightlifting. I've been healthy for many years. I was at about the age of 18, I stopped getting my period and I was started on the pill as a way to remedy that. Recently, I got off of the pill and still haven't menstruated. Unfortunately, I'm going to abbreviate the letter. Danielle has a very low estrogen at the age of 34 and already has pretty substantial osteoporosis with a T-score of minus 2.8. And so she's been working with a nutritionist, trying to take one day off, but she likes to eat a paleo diet and is having trouble getting her periods back. Her nutritionist is telling her she needs to eat more carbohydrates, and Danielle is coming back to me and saying, is that true? And what should I do about the low estrogen and osteoporosis? So first of all, Danielle, I would suggest that you start measuring your BIA. This is bioimpedance analysis, and this will give you a percentage body fat. And you are going to measure this every couple of weeks and work to get your percentage body fat up to 23%, at which point your periods should spontaneously kick in. Now, if I were managing your care, I would really suggest that you consider doing bioidentical hormone replacement therapy for a few months, maybe 6 months, because you're in essentially you're in a loop where you're too thin, you don't have enough fat, so your body won't produce the stimulation to your ovaries to make the estrogen, which would preserve your bones and prevent further bone loss. So I see your osteoporosis issue as fairly urgent and one that should be addressed hormonally, not just dietarily. Once you start on estrogen, you can probably get your body fat up much more easily. And then stop the hormones and your own ovaries will start working and doing the dynamic. But I think you almost have to retrain your body and get the, basically get the fat cells loaded, so to speak, so that the feedback loops that should be generating a normal menstrual cycle and protecting your bones are actually, well, have the support they need from the rest of your physiology. In terms of how you're going to do that, you're going to need to eat more calories than you burn. You could do that with healthy fats, and this might be a situation where lots of avocados and coconut oil, if you're not wanting to do carbohydrates, and you know, that's another way to add fat. If you're going to go with a high-fat or ketogenic-type diet, even ketogenic light, I do recommend monitoring your blood fats, because unfortunately you're testosterone dominant right now. So unless you're doing some hormonal manipulation, you may end up having an adverse effect on your arteries, and we don't want that. So you'll need some monitoring. That there are other ways besides just chowing down on noodles and macaroni to get the situation back where it needs to be. Okay, we're going to move now to another caller, and that is Robert in Ben Lomond. Hello, Robert. Welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
So I had called you several weeks ago, and actually we talked about this a few years ago also, but about I have high homocysteine.
Uh-huh.
And I've always had high homocysteine. I had a genetic workup showing that I had a red flag for the MTHFR
MTHFR mutation, yeah.
Well, and the HFR, I have a yellow flag. But they both deal with homocysteine.
Right.
Anyway, what you had told me was that I'm not metabolizing folic acid and homocysteine back to methionine and that thing. So, and that kind of thing. So you would recommend that that I take 5-hydroxy, this is a tongue twister.
Yeah, I'll do it for you, okay? It's 5-methylfolate or 5-tetrahydrofolate. Tetrahydromethylfolate, yes.
Yeah. Anyway, so I found, I really had a hard time finding it under that name, and I found that they use different names, like one of them is Metafolin.
Yeah, well, what happens, of course, is that you're trying to create a product people can pronounce, and people do deer in the headlights when you have that many syllables. But yeah, Metafolin, sometimes you'll hear it as just methylfolate. I've heard it. Anyway, yes, they're pretty much the target molecule that we're talking about.
Right. So in the past, when I talked to you about it, maybe I wasn't taking enough. I didn't notice any changes. Oh, but my concern also was that I have a kind of a general inflammatory problem. Anything happens to me and I get inflamed with eating gluten or wrapping on an old injury or something, and I just had an unreasonable inflammatory reaction to stuff, and I've been just going from one inflammation to another for a long time. Mm-hmm. But what I noticed was 2 days after taking 4,000 micrograms,
yeah,
of folate every day. 2 days after, I suddenly had a reduction in my pain level.
This was regular folate, right?
No, this is...
This is methylated folate? Okay, all right. And 4,000 micrograms, you said?
Right.
Okay. Which is, substantially high dose.
I mean, that's a good, lot of it.
Well, it's an expensive dose. Although I am seeing a product that Metabolic Maintenance has just put out, one that's like 15 milligrams or something.
That's a lot.
Yeah. And it's not that bad. It works out to about $1 a day.
Yeah, well, that's 15 times as strong as one of these tablets. Each one of these is 1,000 mics.
Yeah. So the point being, people are juicing up the products, and companies are coming up with higher and higher doses and very cost competitive with the lower doses. And the Metabolic Maintenance product, I actually went and ordered. I haven't gotten it yet. But I have some people with treatment-resistant depression who have the MTHFR mutation. And this enzyme is extremely important in the production of your neurotransmitters.
I've had problems with depression.
Yeah, so you see, it could be helpful for you.
Anyway,
it helped your inflammation.
Not a scientific thing, but
yeah,
I can tell you that I went on a trip and I brought enough of it with me to last the whole time of the trip, and then when I got home, I went off on another short trip, and I'd forgotten to bring any with me, and I started to hurt again after 2 days.
Yeah. It doesn't surprise me a bit, because it, first of all, homocysteine itself is pro-inflammatory, and secondly, this is methylation, man. Methylation turns on and off half of, it's the major controlling, one of the major controlling levers for how our genes work. So your metabolism is affected profoundly and immediately if you don't have adequate methylation. Your detoxification is, you know, there are maybe half a dozen mechanisms I could postulate just right off the top of my head about why you get inflamed when you don't have the, your physiology working properly. But isn't it grand that we actually know enough to recommend something that more or less fixes this inborn error of metabolism, which, while it's not lethal and therefore isn't well understood in conventional medical circles, is one of the more fundamental and common things that are off or wrong with people.
Yeah, it sure affected my life for many years.
Exactly. Exactly. So thank you very much for calling and kind of bringing that up to the top of the stack, so to speak, so that other people who maybe haven't been tested by getting their homocysteine measured will do that. And if it's elevated, they could ask their doctor for the MTHFR mutation suite, which will, you know, look for that mutation in particular. And that's stuff that they can get through the regular commercial labs that their insurance covers. You don't have to get fancy here.
Anyway, it was a really great tip, and I thank you for it.
Well, I thank you for calling back and thanking me. Can we get more recursive?
I don't think so.
All right. Well, we'll have to stop then.
All right.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you for the tip.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's do this one. This is actually a really important story, and I want to talk about over-medication. I just talked a little bit about detoxification there, and I want to just say that too much medication is a big problem. And the older you get, the more drugs you find yourself on, and really the fewer drugs you should be on, because the harder it is for your body to break down drugs. So the first thing, and this is steps for family members and people who are over 60 to take tomorrow. And the first step is to actually make a list of what the person is actually taking, including the over-the-counter stuff and the stuff they take every day, but they don't think it's a drug because, hey, it's just an aspirin. And often people are on 3 or 4 blood pressure drugs as they age, and you reach a point in your 60s and 70s where you no longer need as many blood pressure drugs. And it's time to start taking them away. But doctors won't do it, won't easily initiate it. It's something that geriatric specialists try to do, but it's kind of scary and difficult, and it requires guts for a doctor to act in this way. It's just easier to leave people on all these medications because you don't get blamed if something goes wrong. But there's a lot of stuff you don't need to be on when you're older. For example, the benzodiazepines should probably be tapered. This is the Ativan, Valium, Klonopin. We now know they contribute to the development of Alzheimer's, which, if there's no other reason, that's a good enough one to take these drugs. Cholesterol-lowering drugs as you get older, actually higher cholesterol is associated with living longer. So once you get into your 70s or 80s, you probably don't need that statin. Drugs for acid reflux should only be used short-term and not long-term. Products like Benadryl, other anticholinergics, basically any antihistamine, as you age, you want to stay away from those drugs because they have adverse brain effects. And a lot of things need to be tapered. So some things can be stopped, like the antihistamines. Other things need to be tapered. That's where you need your medical advice. But the key point here is that every year, when I see my senior patients, I go through the meds they're on, and the first question I ask myself is, what can we stop? What do we not need? What can we try to stop? And what else is the person taking? So I tell them, bring it all in a bag. Do the exercise yourself and see how much you're actually taking, and then ask yourself, what do I really need and can I stop? And if you're over 60, this advice, this means you. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.